Well, Happy New Year. Guys, we officially made it through 2024, and that is saying something. We are in 2025, yes. Today is, according to the church liturgical calendar, the last day of Christmas, because Christmas, there's 12 days of Christmas, according to the liturgical calendar, which is kind of cool. And many tomorrow will begin the season of Epiphany, which means appearing. And it's in this season of Epiphany that Christians celebrate the appearance, the manifestation of Jesus Christ. So it's kind of like this. Advent is the waiting, right? You're waiting for Christ. And then Christmas is Christ comes, born in the flesh. And Epiphany is sort of the unveiling, the appearing to the world, the manifesting of Jesus to the world. And many celebrate on the 6th of January, the Feast of Epiphany, when they remember the story of the wise men, the three kings of Orient. There were not probably just three, but it doesn't matter. I want to begin with that story because it's kind of a perfect segue out of the Christmas season and into 2025 and a theme I want to hit on this morning. We're going to look up Matthew chapter 2 in the Christian Standard Bible. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of King Herod, wise men from the east arrived in Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born King of the Jews? For we saw his star at its rising and have come to worship him." Let's pause there. Who are these guys? We've never met them before. Wise men is the most common translation, but some of our versions leave the word magi untranslated, okay? They just use that Greek word, magi, which typically refers to like magicians or sorcerers or scientists of the day. These guys were certainly astronomers, certainly astrologers. All of that in the day was sort of lumped together. Can you imagine our university departments having to deal with that nowadays? Anyway, that's who these guys were. We don't exactly know where they were from. We just know they were from the east. That could mean modern-day Saudi Arabia, more likely a little bit further east into Persia, which would be modern-day Iran. So wherever they come from, these guys had been watching the stars. And they saw one particular star that they were very intrigued with. What was the star? Well, we have to remember there's no need to take that word star too literally. The ancients, again, didn't have our classification systems for stars and comets. It was just like something shining up in the air. That's a star. You see a helicopter with a light on? That's a star. It's just very noisy. They didn't have helicopters back then. Just want to throw that out there. A lot of people suggested maybe it was a comet. Maybe it was Halley's Comet. The problem is the math doesn't quite check out for Halley's Comet, so it would have been a little bit early. There is one idea. Now, this is assuming, of course, God could just put a projection up there anytime he wants, right? But there is one theory which I find kind of compelling. It was first put forth by Johannes Kepler hundreds of years ago, and he was suggesting there could have been a convergence of planets. Okay, so when Venus is in the right part of the sky, it's really bright, and you would think, dude, that's a huge bright star. Well, sometimes it happens with Jupiter, sometimes it happens with Saturn, and sometimes those two planets sort of converge. Now, they don't actually hit. Don't worry, the rings of Saturn are going to be just fine. They're millions of miles away, but they line up just perfectly, and it makes it extra bright. So some people have put forward that that's what they were referring to, which is a super interesting idea and a plausible theory because they would have been in that position, at least very close to the time that we think Jesus was born. So it's a plausible theory, but here's what makes it more compelling. I read this from Bishop N.T. Wright, who's, of course, one of the greatest New Testament scholars in the world today. In antiquity, people believed that the planet Jupiter, when they looked in the sky, represented royalty and kingship. Okay? And they also, many people, associated the planet Saturn with the Jewish people. So imagine if these guys had thought that way, and then they see kingship and the Jewish people rise. They think, hey, a new king of the Jews has been born. Isn't that interesting? We don't know if exactly that's what was going on, but it makes sense. It makes big sense. These guys in the east see this thing, you know, coming of the west in the sky, and they're like, we've got to go. Now, if they were, in fact, listening to music at the time, they go, and they decide, we are going to make a journey here. Now, that's a lot. If you look at a map, that's a long way. We're talking about 800 to 900 miles, okay? And they would have probably indeed traveled on the backs of camels, which would have taken a couple of months at least. So these guys, they saw something big happening. They knew it was big. And they said, this is so important that we're going to take probably 4 months out of their year, maybe more, to go and see it. That's some serious dedication, isn't it? So they're important people. They are highly educated scholars, probably wealthy. They might have had official positions almost like kings where they were from. So they look for important people to ask questions about. So they get to Jerusalem and they start asking the question, and they find themselves talking to King Herod himself, who's the puppet king of this region. And Herod, maybe they might have asked him, you know, maybe they thought it was his son that was born and they were trying to bring him flowers. That's not the way he took it. When King Herod heard this, he was deeply disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. So he assembled all the chief priests and scribes of the people and asked them where the Messiah would be born. And in Bethlehem of Judea, they told him, because this is what was written by the prophets. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, because out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. So that's what the passage that they quote, and they say, so he's supposed to come there. Then Herod secretly summoned the wise men and asked them the exact time the star appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully this child. When you find him, report back to me so that I too can come and worship him. After hearing the king, they went on their way, and there it was, the star they had seen at its rising, and it led them until it came and stopped above the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they were overwhelmed with joy. Entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and falling to their knees, they worshiped him. And they opened their treasure and presented him with gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their own country by another route. These gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, these were lavish gifts. According to church tradition, gold represented the kingship of Jesus, frankincense represented his priestly role, myrrh represented his mortality. So you've got Jesus the king, Jesus the son of God, Jesus the human, right in that moment. But remember, these men were not Jews at all. Like, as far as we know, they probably had little to no knowledge of Yahweh, little to no knowledge of the Hebrew scripture and the promised Messiah. And even if they had, they certainly wouldn't have understood like the mystery of the incarnation, right? Even Jesus' own disciples couldn't get that until the very end. So we can't assume that they somehow were in the know, you know, or that they knew God. We can't even really assume that they were particularly righteous. All we know is they knew a king was being born and they wanted to give something lavish. So they gave him 4 months out of their year. They gave him an enormous amount of energy. They made it this precious, arduous journey, and they gave of their resources for a king. Now, there's a lot you can say about this story, you know? Most of the time, the focus is on the fact that here's this Jewish Messiah and these foreigners that are coming, recognizing and worshiping, which Matthew's definitely making a big point about. And then he bookends his book at the very end with the Great Commission saying, go into all the world, right? So we have this beautiful bookend of this Jesus is for all people, all ethnicities, all races, colors, everything. Red and yellow, black and white, right? And that's a beautiful emphasis that should inform us in the way that we see our neighbors and the way that we think about policy and the way that we think just about treating other people. It should inform all those things. But I don't want to talk about this morning. The thing I want to talk about specifically is this other thing. I want to talk about how much joy they had when they gave these gifts. Because, you know, they had to be exhausted by this time. They'd been traveling a long time. Their legs hurt because camels are really wide. So they're walking around like this. He's tired of Barry and how much he snores. Sick of, tired of smelling like camel, all of these things. And here, and but they come in and they see the baby and suddenly all of that's forgotten. All of it, all the frustration, all the exhaustion, all they're like, we did it, we found him, here he is. And they're captured by joy. And as I hear, think about that, I think about the words of Jesus, it is more blessed to give than to receive. We don't know what how Mary and Joseph responded to their entry, but we know how they, the wise men, responded, and it was with pure joy. It is more blessed to give than it is to receive, says Jesus. Notice Jesus didn't say, it is holier to give than to receive. He didn't say it was more morally upright to give than receive. He didn't say it is, in my opinion, and the opinion of heaven's grand accounting department, that it is more beneficial to humanity and the advancement of the kingdom to give than it is to receive. No, he used the term blessed. And you know what the best translation probably for the word blessed is? Happy. Happy. That's why the Good News translation translates Jesus' words, there is more happiness in giving than receiving. So the Amplified adds this phrase, it's more blessed and brings greater joy to give than to receive. And it's why Eugene Peterson in the Message from the good folks at NAB Press says, you are far happier giving than receiving. Isn't that interesting? You are happier giving than receiving. I've been mulling over this idea this week as I've been preparing for this sermon. I've been reading a great book by Randy Alcorn called Giving is the Good Life. And I've been listening to John Mark Comer's, he's got a course from Practicing the Way, specifically on the discipline of generosity. And I as I've been listening to all of this and reading, I've been thinking, is this, you know, this is such a simple idea. And is it actually true? It feels like it's too, I don't know, like it's just interesting. But then I start thinking about my own life. And I was remembering our first Christmas here in Junction City. It was 2009. It's gonna be 16 years since we moved up here, which is hard to believe. We had come here and we had just left YWAM, but we were still sort of in YWAM where you raise all your own funds to work. We had very little support, and we came up here, and I was trying to sort of transition and trying to start this internet business of building websites and things, and we're putting everything on credit, and we're just trying to plow through, and we're going backwards, and nothing's working, and it was so stressful. I'm like, why are we here? What are we doing? And so we told the kids, like, guys, this Christmas is not going to be a huge Christmas. Just want to let you know. And our kids were so awesome about that. They always have been. They're like, are you kidding? It's okay. It's totally fine. And so we're getting ready for Christmas, and I think it was Christmas Eve. We got a knock on our sliding glass doors, and there was this tall man with white hair and a deep, booming voice. Without the beard, that's right. It was Doug Easterday. He was there, and we opened the door, and pretty sure he had Joyce and Janelle with him. And they brought a minivan full of presents. Wow. Their home group had adopted us, see? And had been really sneaky. And we were speechless, and there were tears, and we were so moved by their generosity. And the next year, we weren't in a much better shape. We had just come on, I had come on like third time here, and so they adopted us again the next year. And it was beautiful. I have been on the receiving end of people's generosity so much in my life. That happens when you grow up in YWAM and then you stay in YWAM. And people are like, oh, here is, you know. And I'm so very grateful. Thank you, Doug. I mean, there's people here, I think, that were part of that home group. I will never forget that. And my kids who were old enough back then also will always remember that. It was a dear, beautiful moment. But as the years have gone by, thank God we're not in that same horrible place financially. We paid off our debt with gazelle intensity. We chased that down. And then finally, thanks be to God, we were able to come on full time. And Sarah jumped on. We're just not in the same place. And so suddenly we were like, wait a minute. We are not destitute. We are, for the first time, not financially desperate. This is weird. And so we're like, wait a minute. We actually have a little to give. This is super cool. And we were giving, but, you know, only giving the bare minimum of what we could. And let me tell you, as we've walked that journey, I want to tell you, as beautiful as it was receiving those gifts and as moving and wonderful as it was, I can honestly tell you it's more exciting to give than it is to receive. It's kind of a rush. It's a beautiful thing to be able to give. It really has been true in my life. Now, you don't have to just take my word for it. Some of you guys I know are way better than I am at this already. So you're like, I don't need to be convinced. But I'm going to say all this anyway, because I think sometimes we're nervous about that. But let me read to you just a snippet, and we're gonna try something here. I'm gonna read you a snippet from Randy Alcorn's book. Again, it's called Giving is the Good Life, and he's talking about receiving in terms of the lottery, okay? He says, according to Forbes, 70% of those who suddenly gain large amounts of money lose it all within a few years. This isn't just the huge jackpots. Winnings of $50,000 to $100,000 make it 50% more likely that a person will be bankrupt in 3 to 5 years than if they had won less than $10,000. A Texas man won $31 million, and less than 2 years later, with his spending out of control, he committed suicide. One winner said, my life was brilliant, but the lottery has ruined everything. What's the point of having money when it sends you to bed crying? I thought the lotto win was supposed to be the answer to my dreams. Now those dreams have turned to dust. Now that's sad, isn't it? That's very sad. But now I want to contrast that, okay? Everyone close your eyes for a moment, if you will. Okay? I'm not going to because I need to see what I'm going to say. Close your eyes and think about the most generous person that you know. Or somebody in your top five, okay? Somebody very generous in your life. Could be a family member, could be a friend. Does not have to be a wealthy person. Just someone you're like, man, that's a generous person. I'll give you a moment. Do, 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 do. Okay, open your eyes. All right, let me ask you a question. The face that you pictured, is that face smiling? Look around. Look around. Is that a cheerful person? Okay, so mine was too. It's very cheerful. It's actually someone in this room who I'm not going to embarrass. That's what came to mind. So like, now let's just think about that. Let's just think about that. If we're talking about the majority of people who like win the lottery becoming, and they're like, they're receiving a huge amount, right? To over here, someone who just has a lifestyle of generosity, who's happier? It's not even close. So maybe Jesus was actually being kind of literal here, going, you guys, you're going to be happier if you have a lifestyle of giving than you are if you have a lifestyle of receiving. And I think that's true. It really is more blessed to give than receive. Now, hear me. I know we're talking about an extreme case, right? We really are. There's all kinds of things attached to why that happens. And Jesus really has a whole lot to say, really big warnings about riches in the New Testament that you have to contend with. But most of the time, receiving is wonderful. It's really, really good, isn't it? Most of the time. But even when it's good, giving is better. Now, I'm not just talking about financial resources. In fact, that's not most of what I'm talking about. More of what I'm talking about is thinking about our life, our words, our time, our energy, the things that we have and kind of forget that we have. The thing is, we have something working against us in this department, and it's our own American culture. Because we're often being told that we don't have enough to offer, so we should be on guard against generosity. Like, we should be We should be giving it the side eye. We should be suspicious. We should prioritize ourselves and our own boundaries. I think we're living in a sort of a unique psychological era here. We have this trend, and it's mostly, I think mostly, at least partly, a very good thing. Like, people never used to emphasize boundaries, setting boundaries when I was growing up, at least not that I remember. I'm talking about like boundaries, like safeguards of our time, safeguards on our resources and our relationships, because we really do need to take care of ourselves and our families and in our busy lives with many demands. Boundaries are essential, friends, especially for those who would overdo it, and you know who you are. Some of you guys would bring a dinner to someone's house every single night of the week if you could, and would drain your bank accounts anytime anybody had any need. Boundaries are like caution tape. They're saying, hey, this is important. Don't be reckless. Be wise. Be stewards. Here's the thing, though. I think most people in our Western culture, I dare say, are not really in danger of giving too much. I kind of think, I mean, some are, right? But I kind of fear we've started leaning in the other direction. I kind of think that this boundaries thing has become a really big deal, and some of our boundaries have gotten cushy. And sometimes downright selfish. And I don't just mean financially. Again, I'm thinking relationally. I'm thinking, you know, to the point where we've got these big boundaries in our life, so the only thing we have room for is our family and our job and our 8 Netflix series that we're currently binging. Like, the me time. Like, we've gotten so much me time. Culture tells us to think more about our self-care than the care of our neighbor. And I don't think that's what Jesus intended. And again, please hear me. I'm not saying self-care is bad. Please take care of yourself and your soul. Please. But Jesus, you guys, emphasized giving himself away. That's what he did. He gave himself to us, and he calls us to give ourselves to our neighbors. And I think that ought to be the headline, you know? Like, the boundaries are being emphasized so much that in this American moment that it seems like, you know, this caution tape is the headline. Hey, remember your caution tape, everybody. And we swim in that water because no one wants to mess with caution tape. So we all want to do that. But again, I'm not suggesting we shouldn't have them. I'm simply suggesting this. Maybe we should reexamine our boundaries. Maybe we should think through them again and go, okay, wait a minute. How much of my life am I devoting here? And maybe I actually have more than I thought. There's this great story in all 4 of the Gospels where this boy and his very small lunch feeds 5,000 people. I'm sure you remember it. Great story. Who was the boy and why was he the only one with food? I don't know. I would like to know. Part of me wonders, okay, was he just on a grocery run and got sidetracked like Curious George and ended up in this crowd? I don't know. I think it's more likely that he was with his family and he volunteered their food. Here's the way I think it went. This isn't even in the deep Greek. This is just my imagination. I think he was with his mom and his dad. They were excited to go. And right before they walked out the door, his mom's like, wait, we need snacks. And he's like, oh, mom, like, we're not gonna need to eat. Like, we'll be fine. Like, it's not gonna last that long. None of my friends are bringing their food. And his dad's like, yeah, honey, look, I'm already taking these 3 camp chairs and I've got my umbrella. I've got my drink and my Bible. Like, come on. And she's like, no, snacks make everything better. In case you're wondering, this is an autobiographical story of my family right now. This one loves snacks. And most of the time, I'm at the end going, okay, I guess I'm glad we brought the snacks, okay. Anyway, they get there. However it happened, they get a good seat, and they listen to this incredible teaching, and it's mind-blowing. And they go way past where they thought they were going to go. I'm like, oh my goodness, man, it's late. My stomach is grumbling. And the mom's like, good thing I brought snacks. You're not grumbling now, are you? You know? They're like, fine, mom. And then they overhear the discussion with Jesus and the disciples going, hey, these people are hungry and it would take a small fortune to feed them all. And the boy's like, we've got food. the dad's like, hey, put your hand down, bud. Jesus says, what do we have? Let's pick it up. John 6:9-13. There, Andrew tells him, there's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what is that for so many? And Jesus says, good, perfect. Have the people sit down. And there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. And Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated. So also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost. So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. Okay, someday I want to watch this. Okay, I want to watch the video of this. It's going to be on a big screen, the Omni screen. Oh my God, I knew it. Okay. And it's unlimited pixels, right? We're going to watch this. You guys can watch how you can watch the baskets and see it multiplying, whatever. You can watch the disciples' jaw drop. I only want to see one thing. I want to see the face of the boy who gave the lunch. I want to see his face because I guarantee it was awesome. It was either or. Like this kid. This kid, you know he grew up and was never the same. How thrilled could he have been? Hey, I gave 5 loaves and 2 fishes. I gave our family's picnic basket. Sorry, Dad. It was me. And it's going to be me written about, not you. I gave this, and look what Jesus did with it. It is happier to give than it is to receive. How could he ever be the same after that, you know? I imagine this kid grew up never worrying too much about God not taking care of him, you know? Never thinking, I don't have anything to offer. I bet he didn't struggle much with that because he had this core memory where he thought that he only had a little bit, but he met Jesus Christ and discovered there is no such thing as a little bit in his presence. Have the worship team come. I remember, it's almost 6 years ago now, when Janae McWilliams died. Those who didn't know her, she was a dear part of our congregation, and we were all in mourning. She was especially close to us. She had been with us in Texas for the last 16 years, she'd been a part of our family. And as we're all mourning and going through this really rough time, I am going to embarrass somebody this time because we got a note and a gift from Alicia Orton. And I will never forget, in fact, I think I've even told this story here before, sorry. I will never forget what her note said. Her note said, we can't make everything better. Or it says, I can't make everything better, but I can make salsa. Now, if those who have had Alicia's salsa, you know this was a precious gift. It was our frankincense. That's what it was. And I'll tell you what, guys, I teared up, I cried from that note. The beauty of it, what a beautiful example that is. Because we're limited people, aren't we? Like, do we have what it takes within ourselves to remove the pain of the world? No, of course not. But we have 5 loaves and 2 fishes, I guarantee it. We have something to give, and that something is not insignificant. Little is much in the presence of the great multiplier. Friends, we're at the beginning of a new year. And I want to propose this. Let's let 2025 be a year where we redraw our boundaries. Where we start truly believing that we have more to offer and then we step out. We step out. And we give more of our time for our loved ones and to strangers. More time for hospitality and opening up our homes. More of our resources to go to the poor, to the work of the kingdom, and to the hardworking waitress who took the time to explain that if we use the lunch special instead of the soup of the day, we would pay less. Give more words of praise to our children. Let's give more grace to our spouses. Let's give the benefit of the doubt more often to those with whom we disagree. In other words, in 2025, let's let go of the fear of running out. Let's take Jesus at his word that giving is actually really and truly better than receiving. Let's redraw our boundaries this year. And let it be a year of joyful generosity. For Jesus, the great multiplier, has arrived. We have seen his star in the east, and we have come to worship him. Let's stand together and sing this song.